You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. This is episode 452. I'm saying that just so that it sounds like we've done more than the Christian Humanist podcast has, even though we are... I don't actually know what episode this will be. We're recording this a couple of weeks before it drops. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Ed Song. Ed is associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Ed, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm very well. And yourself?
Not too bad. The semester has felt long, and I would imagine by the time that this drops, it will have felt longer. But other than that, it hasn't been bad by any stretch of the imagination. Just, seems to be the eternal semester. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why. It's probably the student's fault. Maybe my wife's fault. I don't know.
It's spring. It's the end of the semester. I think there's a noticeable difference in the student's performance and demeanor between the spring and the fall semesters.
Yeah, that's probably true. There's probably an argument to be made to getting away from the semester system as it exists, since people don't go home to work on, you know, the farm anymore.
Yeah, but, you know, so UCSB operates on a quarter system. So right. They have 2-month-long quarters, and then when a quarter ends, maybe there's a month in between the start of the next quarter. And, yeah, you know, I don't know that that's not a superior system.
I don't know. I heard of a school in South Dakota that did it was 60 days on and then 20 days off and then just all year round excluding holidays. It was always kind of intriguing, but I don't know if they still do it or not. It was one of those sort of vague rumors you heard.
The weird thing from my perspective, so I taught there as an adjunct for a year or something. I can't remember. Maybe I just taught two or three classes. And it's just crazy because the semester, I mean, it's an 8-week semester. And so teaching it, especially putting the syllabus together, it was sort of like, oh, I didn't, you have to totally change your syllabus because it's like half as long. It just flew. Right. But there was something fun about that in some ways.
Well, speaking of stuff that's not fun, we should talk about healthcare. How's that for a transition?
Very, very professional, Coyle Neal.
Thanks. To flip it around a little bit from what we talked about before the show, why don't you tell us a little bit about what healthcare costs in America, and then I'll have something to say about maybe why it is that way.
Yeah, so we wanted to do a healthcare episode just because healthcare is in the news a lot these days. I would say that there are two reasons why healthcare is a really big deal, and one is kind of moral, and the other is like wholly practical and economic. And the moral reason is just like lots of people don't have health care. So the rate of non-elderly uninsured in the United States over the last 30 years has kind of hovered around 16%, right? So 16% of the non-elderly population doesn't have health insurance. And it's really easy to sort of get lost in the statistics and numbers and sort of forget what the human cost of that looks like. But that means that 16% of the country, men, women, and children, can't really afford healthcare, right? Or...
Well, they can't really afford health insurance.
That's right. But then as a result, their ability to afford healthcare can be prohibitive. So, like, if you have a job, you have health insurance. On Monday, you discover you have cancer. On Tuesday, you lose your job. You know, you're screwed. Like, that's a catastrophe in people's lives. And, you know, when you look at the sources that drive people to declare personal bankruptcy, like, I wish I had that statistic at my fingertips, but I want to say, like, I was going to say the vast majority. A lot of that is people going into bankruptcy because of healthcare costs. Somebody gets sick, and then they have to try to pay for medical treatments, and it drives people into bankruptcy. But in any case, that non-insured rate for the non-elderly is sort of historically hovered around 16%. Under Obamacare, for what it's worth, by 2016, that number had dropped to 8.6%, almost in half. But sort of the more reason why I think we should care about healthcare is that just like before Obamacare, 16% of the country was uninsured, and that was a catastrophe in millions of people's lives. But
I'll push back on those numbers in a minute, because that number is not entirely true.
All right, well, so we can talk about that. The other reason why so that's the moral reason. The practical reason is that like healthcare spending in the United States is orders of magnitude higher than it is in virtually every part of the world. So in 2015, healthcare spending as a percentage of GDP in the United States hit almost 18%. Right, so almost one out of every $5 that are spent in the United States is a healthcare dollar. If you, in contrast, the global average, like the global average of all countries is under 10%. And when you compare likes to like, when you compare the United States to other OECD, advanced industrialized countries, France is at 11.5%. Germany is at about 11.3%. Iceland is just under 9%. Denmark is just under 11%. The UK is at 9.1%, right? So other countries spend half as much on healthcare as we do, right? And so we're spending twice as much on healthcare, right? Which is twice as much that we're not, that isn't being saved and invested or put into infrastructure or put into education or whatever. It's just like, it just costs more in the United States. And
I'll just finish this bit.
And it's not like our healthcare is buying us better coverage. So when you look at national healthcare outcomes, the United States is extraordinarily mediocre relative to other countries in the world. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, but it buys us extraordinarily mediocre healthcare outcomes. So in a Commonwealth Fund study, the United States was ranked last among 11 developed nations. And you just look at like objective measures of health, we rank near the bottom in infant mortality, comparing ourselves to other OECD countries. We are last in life expectancy at birth. We have the highest percentage of the over 65 population with two or more chronic illnesses. We have the highest obesity rate. We're like good. We're like the care itself is good, but it's expensive. But when you look at like objective indicators of national health, we're like really mediocre. So that to me is like why healthcare is a really big existential kind of a deal, both for like these moral reasons and also just for practical reasons. It's like we can't keep doing healthcare this way when it costs so much.
Right. Yeah. So I was going to talk a little bit. I'll respond to that, but I think before we get into sort of the places where we disagree, I think something that I suspect we'll mostly agree on is the question of why is it so expensive to go to the doctor? So sort of wind America back in time, 50, 60, 70 years. It is still an expensive thing to go to the doctor, but it's not crazy expensive. It's sort of the equivalent today of going to the dentist, right, or going to a plastic surgeon. Those are sort of the two of the places where
you have personal experiences with both of those things.
I actually do. The dentist, of course, because I go to a dentist, and in our particular part of the country, we don't have that many dermatologists, so plastic surgeons actually fill in, which is great because they're way cheaper than a dermatologist.
You are getting ice sculpting for your legs or something like that.
Yeah. You know, I had to
collagen injections for your lips. Your lips are looking particularly luscious and full today, Quill.
Oh, thank you. Excellent. The Botox that's really doing it. So you know what happened to the basic medical care side of it. Why has dentistry, plastic surgery, why have they sort of stayed constant, and why is why have doctor visits taken off? And there's some historical reasons for that. Which of these is most important? I don't know that there's necessarily agreement on, but whichever one you pick is the one that's going to affect your view on policy. So one argument says that it's just sort of inflation, that things naturally get expensive over time. That includes kind of new technology that comes along. So just like buying a car is disproportionately more expensive today than it was 100 years ago, in the same way going to the doctor is disproportionately
Well, even when you expensive. Account for inflation? I think that's true.
So. I don't know that it's as much more expensive, right? But I think it is still more expensive. So I don't know that, you know, spending $40,000 on a new pickup is the equivalent of spending, you know, $300 for a Model T.
Accounting for, you know, not inflation?
A Model T, I don't know.
In the...
Yeah, again, because, well, for whatever the reasons, without having to argue about cost of vehicles, I think there is a growth that is more than just inflation.
I don't know that that's true.
But again, I don't think it's the same. It's not exponentially the same as it is with healthcare.
Well, that's certainly true.
Right. So it is more expensive, but it's not as much more expensive. In any case, if the increase is just something that happens over time and is the result of natural processes, then there's really nothing that can or should be done to regulate it, because it's the sort of thing that's going to happen regardless of what the law says. Another argument that's given, this is the one that, you know, if we'd been having this conversation, doing this episode a decade ago, this is what we would have talked about, frivolous lawsuits, right? The number one medical cost for a physician is malpractice insurance. At least that was the case. I don't know if that is the case this year, but until very recently, that's been sort of their number one expense, even more so than medical school, because it's ongoing for their entire practice, and eventually your medical school loans are paid off. Again, I haven't checked to see if that was still true in 2016, but at least as of a few years back, that was it. So the big curative for the cost of healthcare 10 years ago, everyone was talking about tort reform, right? Let's fix this problem of frivolous lawsuits. That will help with the costs of malpractice insurance, and that will bring our overall healthcare costs down. Another argument that gets thrown out is the corporatization of doctor's offices. So instead of going to your local family physician who, you know, operates out of his home or operates out of an office space that he rents in the downtown square of your town, more and more doctor's offices are run through centralized administrative units, often centered out of a hospital or a regional network of hospitals, which, you know, whatever you have in your area is probably different than whatever I have in my area, but obviously, some of these are national as well. Now, that doesn't automatically make healthcare more expensive, although it does add administrative costs. But what it ultimately does is remove flexibility from the system. So when I'm going to my family physician, who is, you know, his own boss, runs his own practice, he and I can come to an agreement on what I'm going to pay him for, you know, healthcare. I can't do that with the corporate entity that owns my local doctor's office today. In the same way, you know, Walmart's tire center is, you know, maybe it's cheaper than the guy's shop down the street from me, but I can't have my tires changed at Walmart in exchange for a day spent painting his house, you know, painting the manager's house. So that corporatization of medicine is another argument. Yet another argument, government regulation, and we see this, I think, somewhat incontrovertibly with Obamacare, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I should have looked these up, but the price of health insurance premiums spiked with the coming of Obamacare, and we saw this, of course, most recently last year when the average growth in healthcare premiums was, what, like 30%, 35%?
Well, so that's for premiums on the Obama – for policies on Obamacare exchanges, not for overall policies that, I mean, most Americans get health insurance through their employer.
Right. So it was less overall, but it was still a significant increase.
That's certainly true, though. We can talk about that later, but I would say that's like for very specific acute reasons. But anyways.
Right. Namely government
regulation. No, that's not the reason.
It's a very specific and acute season.
But that's not the reason. We can talk about that later.
So yeah. So and we should. Those four again are all sort of. I think we could kick any of those around. I think the one that I settle on is ultimately the rise of health insurance as an industry itself. So this is sort of my interpretation. What makes medical care expensive is the separation of the patient from the physician. When you insert sort of a third party into that, be it the government or be it a healthcare, a health insurance provider, you're automatically adding more cost to the mix just by definition. So obviously, if healthcare is what it used to be, or health insurance is what it used to be, and it's this backup thing that you have in case something goes terribly wrong, and the rest of the time you're just interacting on your own dime with your doctor and so on, that keeps costs down. When we bring health insurance into the mix, that across the board starts to raise prices. And if you think about what an average doctor's visit looks like today, you can sort of see that in practice, right? You go to the doctor, you do your thing, and then the doctor, or not even the doctor, right? The whatever company, whatever administration owns your doctor's office has a negotiated something with the health insurance company, a price they have together agreed to pay. I'm trying to say this without specifically blaming any one person, particularly anyone in the town that I live in. Once doctors realize, and I shouldn't say doctors because, again, it's administrators. Once the people who do the billing and who are in charge of making sure that hospitals and physicians and so on are in the black rather than in the red realize that they're going to be able to charge more than any given patient can afford to pay by himself, again, that's when systemically we start to see costs increase, right? If I had to pay for everything myself and everyone else were using health insurance, I would never be able to pay for that. If only a handful of people were using health insurance and only in, you know, actual dire circumstances, I believe costs would be significantly lower. So I guess I blame the health insurance industry itself, which isn't to say that the health insurance industry is a bad idea. I mean, obviously, if I need a heart transplant, it's a good idea to have health insurance. Should health insurance pay for my visit for a physical, you know, when I go in once a year for a physical? Well, maybe it would be better if they didn't pay for that at all and that were just on me. And then the cost of a physical would be manageable according to whatever the community is. I don't know if I'm saying that as well as I should have, but hopefully that's somewhat clear.
Yeah. So I'm going to disagree with a lot of that. I guess that's not any particular surprise. Like, I want to suggest that the cost of healthcare, the inflation that we've experienced over the last 50 years, is driven by some different complex economic factors. But just like on a few things that you just said, like, so tort reform, people talk a lot about tort reform, and it's not as if tort reform wouldn't have any effect. I mean, there are a couple things to say about that. I mean, one question is sort of like a moral question. Like, if a surgeon makes a really negligent and egregious mistake, I mean, so if they, for example, like, cut off the wrong leg, how much compensation?
And that's why it's impossible, right? That's why you can't actually do tort reform. Because there's no way to reform it without reforming out the legitimate lawsuits.
Yeah, so you know there's a kind of a question there about what that tort reform would, like, the kinds of caps that it would set and the extent to which those caps are immoral. But you know, even if there was significant tort reform, like, there's a way in which, I mean, you mentioned the thing about malpractice insurance, like. I don't know that that's the biggest cost. I mean, it depends. I mean, it depends on how you figure costs. But I'm looking at information here that suggests that, so in Minnesota, malpractice insurance could cost anywhere from $4,000 a year to $17,000 a year, depending on your specialty. In California, a surgeon can expect to pay anywhere from $22,000 to $34,000 per year. It's probably going to be higher if you are an OBGYN. But even looking at that let's say it's $34,000 a year. Now, that's a lot of money, but in the revenue that a doctor's office is generating, that's a tiny percentage. You know, let's say we had massive tort reform, and that meant that those premium... I mean, even if they didn't have to buy malpractice insurance at all, they're only saving $30,000 a year or $20,000 a year or $5,000 a year. Like, that's not what's driving healthcare costs.
Right. And again, the argument was, once upon a time, at least a few years back, I don't know that this is still the case, that was the largest single expense. Right. So fixing, like, that's an easy sort of one line item to focus on and change. It's like when people look at the national budget and say, gosh, you know, the largest single expense, I think it's probably still Social Security. So Social Security reform, right, wouldn't fix everything, but it's at least one thing that we could look at.
Yeah, you know, so maybe that's true, but I guess it also depends on how you count single expense. So, like, if I'm paying $34,000 a year, I'm certainly spending a lot more on labor costs for my staff. I mean, that's cheaper than a single nurse. It's certainly cheaper than an MRI machine that I might buy that's going to be millions of dollars. So I guess it just depends. And even if that's true, it's still going to be virtually a negligible expense, even if we say that doctors didn't have to buy it anymore. You know, and as for the centralization bit, there's something a little bit funny in that story that you're telling just from an economic perspective, because usually consolidation is going to lead to efficiencies, right? That's why companies like getting big. I would say that the main thing – so there is the centralization bit, but one thing that's going on is just that medical care is a lot more complex than it used to be. You know, so in the good old days, you could go to your country doctor and, you know, he was the only physician – who would ever treat you. But the bad news is that, like, there were going to be lots of things that, like, you know, if you had certain kinds of cancer, it was just, well, tough luck, you know?
Sure. You have to go see a specialist, right? I mean, that's... Then you have to go to Rochester and go to the Mayo Clinic, and that's when it gets expensive.
Yeah. I mean, so...
We've now brought the Mayo Clinic to, you know, the small town. I mean, that's... The nice part is we have the better, you know, sort of the, like you said, the more complex care. The downside of it is we also bring Mayo Clinic prices with us.
Well, yeah, so that's right. So we're able to cure a lot more diseases, and people have, well, if you can afford it, you have access to that. But that means that care gets more complex, so there's greater specialization. Specialization is good. It means you're getting higher quality level of care, but it also means that healthcare gets a lot more expensive and complicated. And, you know, you're certainly right that, like, there is something a little bit weird about, like, the structure of the way that healthcare gets financed and paid for. Like, consumers, it's in a consumer's interest to get as much medical care as they possibly can, because they're not footing the bill, right? You pay the insurer, but now the insurer is paying the bill. And so that produces all kinds of really wacky incentives going on, right? If I'm not paying the bill, then I want to get consume as many healthcare resources as I possibly can. Somebody else,
as the person paying the bill, will let.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right.
Which we'll get back to that at the end. I mean, that's, if you're not paying the bill, you're not ultimately making the decisions.
Or at least somebody else is weighing in. In the decision-making process. But, you know, I want to suggest that the reason why there's so much inflation is just because the healthcare market in the United States is a really perverse kind of a market, and that healthcare markets are inherently resistant to free market efficiency. And the reason why we see a lot of inflation is because we have this really perverse mixed kind of market that actually produces inflationary pressures. So if you think about, you know, why free markets work, like, I think free markets are like amazing things. They're amazingly powerful things. They're able to produce the goods that we want at a higher quality and a lower price than any other mode of economic production. But if you think about why they work, they only work because in certain kinds of environments, you need to have something approaching perfect information, and you need to have something approaching perfect competition. Now, those both represent idealizations. But like if competition is just that, like, you need to have enough providers of the good in question to generate a level of competition. If there's only one grocery store in town, then their prices there are going to be really high, and probably the quality of their goods is going to be really low because there's no competitive pressure for them to care about either of those things. You add a second grocery store. Now both prices and quality of goods is going to improve. You add a third grocery store. You add a fourth grocery store. You add a fifth grocery store. You get lots of grocery stores, and you get really good competition, again, which encourages good, high-quality goods at low costs. But equally, in order for that to work, you also have to have a robust and rich information environment. You know, you could have 20 supermarkets in your vicinity where you could go and buy milk, but if you didn't know that there were 20, then that wouldn't do you any good. You might as well just have one. Or equally, if you didn't know what their prices were, or if you didn't know about the quality of their goods, equally it wouldn't matter. You might as well have just one, right? So, in order for free markets to work their magic, you have to have a kind of a threshold with regard to the information that's available and to the competition exists has to be crossed. And then...
Maybe this is where you're going, but at least in the extremes, right, you can't have a free market with healthcare. And this is... There was a Forbes article about this a couple of years ago that basically says, look, if you're bleeding out... and go to the ER, you can't stop to negotiate over the costs, right? They patch you up, and then you pay what they tell you to. Like, there's not there can't be a free market in that particular environment.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, by definition, it can't be there.
Or, you need to call an ambulance. You can't be like, oh, well, wait a second, and then figure out, like, how much it's going to cost, and, like, you know, you call one person, you call one ambulance company and you're like, I need a pickup. How much is that going to cost? Ooh, $10,000. Let me call somebody else. You know, you can't. But that's exactly right. And so if you think about healthcare as a commodity, like clothing and shoes and computers and food, I mean, for one thing, healthcare is a really strange commodity. Sometimes when I go to the grocery store, it's like they have the really beautiful, gnarly-looking heirloom tomatoes that taste amazing but cost $5 a pound from Whole Foods. And sometimes it's like I want to buy one of those. But sometimes I don't feel like spending $5 on healthcare. I just need tomatoes, and I'm gonna save money and buy the perfectly round, kind of pale red tomatoes that cost $1 a pound but basically taste like cardboard, you know, and sometimes I'll do that. With a lot of goods that we consume, we're willing to make trade-offs between cost and quality depending on how we feel about things, right? But if you think about healthcare, like, healthcare is a really strange commodity. Except for in really marginal cases, you're not likely to trade off quality of care for cost. Like, you're not going to get the cut rate, you know, you need gallbladder surgery. Like, you're not going to go to the cut rate gallbladder surgeon to get the procedure done. And that just has to do with, like, the nature of healthcare. Like, healthcare, our health is kind of an ultimate good, you know, which just makes it basically different from everything else that we consume. And then with regard to those two factors that I mentioned earlier, like information and competition, if you think about the information environment, it's just like it's inherently compromised with healthcare. When I walk into McDonald's, I know how much a Big Mac is going to cost me. But when you walk into a doctor's office, they don't tell you how much things are going to cost. I remember once when I was in grad school, I had health insurance as part of my grad school package. And I had dental insurance. So, like, I went to the dentist and to get a cleaning, and I give them my card when I'm checking in. And they're like, great. And then they go and I do the cleaning. And at the end of the cleaning, they give me the little 1 ounce of fluoride rinse, you know, that you swish around in your mouth and you spit out. And so I do that. And then I walk out. And I go to the desk person. And they're like, well, your health insurance is covering is covering the whole visit except for the fluoride rinse. I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. How much was the fluoride rinse? And it was $17, you know?
Which presumably they would have told you beforehand if you'd asked.
They would have.
Like, dentistry and plastic surgery, again, are two of the places where you still can find out what something costs before you get
That's true, but it's... Yeah, so a couple things about that. You can. They typically give you nasty looks when you ask, and they don't tell you unless you asked.
Right.
And if you just think about that $17, it's not like there was something magical about that fluoride rinse. Like, I could probably go to Costco and buy basically a lifetime supply of fluoride rinse for $17. Why did it...
It was just Listerine.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, why did it cost me $17? It's because they could charge $17. Now, like, on the pricing front, like, they could change that. They could put a big menu of services up in the office when you walk in, and you can... You know, that would be more honest. There are ways in which you can improve that. But, like, and just talking about, like, other factors about information, again, it's just, like, information in the healthcare environment is inherently compromised. It's, like, you go to one, you have headaches. You go to one doctor. The doctor says you have a tumor. You go to a second doctor. That doctor says that you have too much gluten in your diet. You go to a third doctor. They say, "Yeah, you have a tumor," but they recommend a totally different treatment than the first doctor. You know, you don't really know how good any of these doctors are. There's just all of this mystery that make it really difficult to make informed decisions. And there's just something essential. There's something inherent about the nature of healthcare that makes that information environment. Just like you just don't know.
Well, and the doctors may not.
Well, yeah, well, that's that's exactly my point. It's all kind of mysterious. If you knew exactly what it was and you knew exactly what the doctor's success rate was in treating that exact illness, then you could make more informed decisions. But like that kind of information, we are not likely to possess that kind of information anytime in the near future. And then, so that's the information environment. And then, if you think about competition. Competition for any good is influenced by the costs of entry into that particular market. It's influenced by the mobility of productive factors. And if you think about medicine, it's like the factors that matter the most are labor supply. And just given the level of training that you need, the labor is always there's always going to be a labor shortage. And there's always going to be, and, you know, the costs of opening up a modern healthcare facility are extremely high. And both of those things put together just mean that there isn't going to be quite enough competition in the healthcare markets to engender the kinds of efficiency that it's possible for markets to create. So,
again, not to keep going back to this, yet we still have dentists and plastic surgeons who do it. So it is possible. Right, we can't say it doesn't happen. It happens somewhere.
Yeah, you know, and
we have to be able to explain why does it work for them.
Yeah, so that's a good point. And you know, it's not. I don't know if you have numbers available. It's not entirely clear to me that there hasn't been a similar level of inflation for dentists and plastic surgeons. But let's say that that's right.
No, I do.
All right, so that's fine. Let's say that's right. It's worth sort of thinking about like the difference between those kinds of things and the things that other doctors are doing. The you know equally there are other so if you look at like the cost of LASIK eye surgery, that's right. Like
another good example.
It's extraordinarily cheap, and like I'm sure prices have gone down since that technology was introduced. And you know I would say what's going on in all three of those things. Is that the good in question that you're getting from all of those procedures is relatively simple, relatively straightforward. The information environment is far less compromised. It's like when you're going to get a cleaning, you know you're going to get a cleaning. If you're getting a cavity filled, you know you're getting a cavity filled. It's not like those procedures have the kind of complexity that make the information environment particularly complicated. One thing with LASIK eye surgery is that it's basically all done by machines, you know? And so, like, it's possible for that procedure to be automated in a way that other kinds of healthcare procedures just can't be automated. So that totally changes the structure of the economics for the provision of healthcare in those like very narrow slices of life, right? Which is why earlier I said something about healthcare prices going up, except for marginal cases. And so I would say, yeah, dentistry, plastic surgery, LASIK eye surgery, those are all marginal cases in which you can sort of explain exactly why you haven't seen the inflationary pressures in those areas. And it's precisely because those areas are just so different from other kinds of illnesses. But economists have a name for markets in which you can't, when you don't have perfect information and perfect competition. They're called second best markets. And there's an economic theory that was generated in the 1950s by these two economists called the general law of the second best. And the idea there is that when you have a second best market, when you have a market in which you don't have something approaching perfect information and perfect competition, attempts to make that market more market-like in some but not all respects actually won't make that market more efficient. It might make that market more efficient, but it actually might make that market less efficient. The idea is that, like, when you don't have perfect information and perfect competition, attempts to make that market more market-like are actually going to have, like, totally unpredictable results. Like, information and competition are like threshold things. And if you don't achieve a minimum threshold in both categories, then you're just not going to get economic efficiency. And you get really perverse results. And then, so I would say that's like healthcare markets are an example of second best markets par excellence. And because it's really clear why the information and competition environments are compromised. And then it's also really clear, like, the perverse results that produces. And you just see that in the rising cost of healthcare. And then just to finish the story, the only way, all of that gives you a reason to try to regulate that market. And when you have second best markets, the way to achieve the most efficient outcome is actually to regulate them. And so that provides a kind of a practical argument, not even a moral argument, but a practical argument in favor of regulating healthcare markets, because it's the only way that you can control costs. And again, like, you look at every other advanced industrialized country in the world, like, they're paying half as much as we are on healthcare, and they're getting better healthcare outcomes. It's not every other country in the world has solved this problem, and they've solved it by heavily regulating their healthcare markets. So, like, we can talk about socialized medicine. I actually think that's a little bit of a misnomer. In the UK, the healthcare providers are public, and the healthcare insurance scheme is public. You have a public system. But in other countries, you can have a mix. So you can have public healthcare providers and a private insurance system, or you can have private healthcare providers and a public healthcare, a public insurance system, or you could have private. Germany, for example, I think has a private system. They have private health insurance, but it's just like both are really heavily regulated. And so effectively, what you're doing is you're setting a cap on costs. You're saying, this is how much we're spending on healthcare this year. And then that sets a hard cap on costs, which enables you to control costs. And then you go to healthcare providers and you say, look, you guys are the experts on this. This is how much we're paying. You figure out the best way to spend it. And that, like, that works for every other country in the world. They pay half as much as we do and get better healthcare outcomes.
Depending on which country you're talking about. I mean, obviously, healthcare costs significantly less in Cuba. But I don't know that should necessarily be our model.
Well, sure, but they also cost half as much in Germany or half as much in the UK.
Yeah, and that's that raises an interesting point. And like I said, I was going to push back on some of your stuff. But first, anything else on...
No,
on,
that's it for me.
Okay. So before we get to Obamacare, obviously this difference in cost is is a real thing between the United States and the European nations, mm-hmm. which again raises questions as to why that's the case. So I think conservatives should go ahead and grant, yeah, healthcare in Denmark, like healthcare in, you know, communist China, the old Soviet Union, and so on, is a smaller part of the GDP than it is here,
yeah.
which raises the question as to why. So I think there are a lot of factors that include but aren't limited to research costs being probably the biggest one. In 2014, the last year I've got numbers for, the U.S. accounted for 44% of all medical research being done in the world. Granted, that's down from 57% 10 years before, but it also includes almost all pharmaceutical research, which is included in our, you know, how much are we spending on healthcare?
I don't think that's
all sort of jumbled together.
I don't think that's true.
Because when you buy drugs, that's going towards, like, the purchase of prescription drugs is included as the part of the calculations.
Yeah, but that's not, it's not including the cost spent in developing the drugs. So when you look at healthcare spending, it's certainly including the price of drugs,
but it's not including the cost of
the research that was necessary to develop those drugs.
Right, and the issue that comes up there, so drugs specifically are in sort of a neutral category because we don't know what drug production costs. We know that aspirin is cheap, right, or free mm-hmm. if you've had, you know, intro to chemistry, and that the boutique drugs for rare diseases are expensive. Mm-hmm. But drug companies just don't publish their internal expenses. Mm-hmm. They're not required to. So we don't always know how much the basic cost of the drug actually is. So it all sort of gets lumped together. Also, I don't know that I've seen stats on the breakdown of what we spend on psychiatric drugs compared to what other nations spend. And then within that, the breakdown of drugs that, you know, people take because they struggle with terrible mental illness compared to what people take because of, you know, first world ennui. I don't know sort of where that line is. But again, almost all medical research or the majority of medical research from any single nation happens in the United States. I mean, we are just more than anyone else. And even if you are excluding drug companies, it is still often practicing physicians who are doing some of that research. So they're still sort of standing on both sides of that. We do more clinical trials than the European Union and more than every nation in Asia put together. Another reason, so pharmaceutical costs we've already mentioned is a bigger one. It may be that we just pay closer to what the medicine actually costs, at least since European nations put strict price controls on specific medicines. Here, of course, we have health insurance companies that might negotiate with the drug companies, but the government isn't involved in regulating that. So again, and because we don't know the internals of drug companies, we just don't know. Another reason that healthcare is more expensive here, maternity care. Our birth rate is down, and sort of dangerously so. But it's expensive to have a baby, and we're still having more of them than Europe. Now, the infant mortality thing that you mentioned earlier, does that include abortion rates?
Like No.
Okay, I would imagine that if you account for that, it comes closer. But again, I don't have the numbers in front
yeah.
of me. I know that as a percentage, there are more of them in Europe than there are here, but I don't know how those numbers balance out in the end. It may be that if Europeans were trying to have as many babies as Americans are, their mortality rates would balance out a little bit. But again, I don't have the numbers in front of me. The fact that we do go ahead and have more of them per capita than most European nations, again, maternity care is just expensive. So it makes sense that our rates are going to be a little bit higher. And then in general, I mean, at the end of the day, cost healthcare is more expensive here because we are less healthy than the rest of the first world. And it's largely a lack of health that is tied to lifestyle choices. And to some extent, that's one of the reasons you're really not going to sell me on the left's view of healthcare. Even if tomorrow, and certainly you're not going to sell me on any single payer system, you know, even if tomorrow we jack our tax rates up to 40% and declare universal coverage for everyone, all various European nations, it wouldn't make anything cheaper because we're not any healthier. All it would do is remove yet more of our control over the system and export it to bureaucrats and administrators. So until Americans get their act together, you're just not going to convince me that you, Edward Song the Marathoner, should pay for my health care, me, Coyle Neal the Donut Eater. Like that, there's just something unjust about that particular arrangement.
Uh-huh. Can I push back on some of that stuff?
You can, before we move on to Obamacare, yeah.
So the medical research isn't a healthcare expense. That's a whole other kettle of fish. Pharmaceutical costs are a healthcare expense.
Right.
And that's being factored in there. The United States certainly pays more in pharmaceutical costs than other countries, primarily because other countries negotiate with pharmaceutical providers to get lower rates than we do. Now, which we do not do.
Unless your health insurance company does it.
Yes. Now, you know, maybe it's the case that in paying higher rates for pharmaceuticals, we are effectively underwriting the production of pharmaceuticals for the rest of the world. I mean,
And there's no way to know.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily true what you said earlier. It's not true that pharmaceutical companies don't publish their research costs. I mean, assuming that they're a public company, they have to release their quarterly public financial statements in which they talk about costs and revenues. And so you're not getting a precise breakdown of where those costs
right.
come. Though I actually expect that they itemize that a fair bit. But in any case, when we know that the vast majority of those companies are making money, how much more money are they making given the high cost of pharmaceuticals in the United States is maybe that's a little bit of a mysterious thing. Maybe it's the case that they couldn't produce the drugs if we were paying just what all the other countries in the world were paying. But in any case, it's pretty clear that the price of pharmaceuticals could well go down if we are more aggressive in pursuing similar kinds of discounts. So, like, you know, I think you're right about the point about pharmaceuticals, but, like, when you sort of factor in what the costs could be if we were engaging in similar kinds of negotiations, like, that's not the major driver of healthcare. And then equally, like, you know, our birth rate is higher in the United States, but it's not like it's orders of magnitude higher. The factors that you mentioned, like, they might be factors. I mean, kind of like the malpractice insurance bit. Like, those might be factors, but, like, those are factors on the margins of things. And the vast majority of it is just like procedures are more expensive. Like, so, you know, you can look at the costs of specific procedures between various different countries, and it's like
sure.
it just costs less. You know, so a knee replacement in a European country is going to cost half as much in the United States. I mean, part of it is as well that
it takes several times as long.
Not necessarily. I mean the
stats I have are for England and specifically on knee replacement.
Mm-hmm.
4 months for a crucial operation, which knee replacement is considered, a 4 month waiting period. Averaging all of them out, the wait is 12 to 18 months. So all surgical operations average.
Mm-hmm.
The wait is 12 to 18 months, 4 months for crucial operations.
Mm-hmm. And what's the waiting time in the United States?
For crucial operations, although I don't know if it includes knee replacement or not, I was not able to find
mm-hmm.
that. 1 to 2 months.
Yeah, so, you know, so maybe that's right. And again, I'd like want to know what crucial replacements are. But in general, when people tell those horror stories about, like, their experiences waiting, like, I mean, everybody has a horror story. The more important issue is, like, when you look at aggregated statistics about people's satisfaction with their healthcare systems. And, like, those, like, people in European countries are far happier with their healthcare systems than, like, we are in ours. But in any case, I mean, the main point that I was going to get at is that, like, you just look at the cost of specific procedures, and it's, like, twice as much. It's just, like, twice as much in other countries. Doctors in the United States make a lot more money than their counterparts do in other countries. Like, some of the things that you mentioned might be factors, but they're really just factors on the margins. The thing that's driving it is that it just costs more. Procedures cost more. And the reason why they cost more is because we have this imperfect, second-best, hodgepodge market. whereas other countries have unified healthcare systems where they're able to control costs. And you know, even you know, on the waiting time thing, so that's fine. Like, we could spend a little bit more money if we wanted to, trying to improve healthcare availability. I mean, one thing that's going on there, there's probably longer wait times, is that everybody has access to a doctor, whereas in the United States, not everybody has access to a doctor, right? So if there are more, if there are fewer people looking to use a service, then you're going to have to wait less. The United States actually has fewer doctors per capita than a lot of the comparable OECD countries. But like, if that was a really big deal to you, that's fine. You could spend a little bit more money. And then we would be paying, instead of close to 20%, we'd be paying something like 13% or something like that. I mean, again, to me, like, just the big issue is that, like, it's not like this is rocket science. Every country in the world pays less and gets better healthcare outcomes than we do. With regard to your point about, like, healthcare choices, you know, that's true in a way. Because the real reason why our healthcare outcomes are worse, it doesn't have to do with the quality of the care itself. It just has to do with the fact that lots of people are poor and don't have access to healthcare in the United States. And I suppose you could say that they make bad healthcare choices. But it's not
we
like...
You could certainly say they make bad healthcare choices.
Bad health lifestyle choices. But it's not like those decisions just happen in a vacuum, that they're just weak-willed, bad people. I mean, they happen because they're poor. You know, there's a reason why poor people make bad health decisions. It's because they're poor. It's arising in part for structural reasons. And the reason why citizens in, say, European social democracies, why they're healthier is because they're not poor. I mean, to me, like, you're right. But that, to me, just sort of highlights the structural causes of poverty, not the weakness of character of Americans.
Yeah, and I think I'm happy to say it's probably both. I don't know that you can, at this point, and granted, this is probably far too sweeping a statement, in some ways, our choices about our health are similar to smoking. No one can really say, I didn't know that smoking was bad for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, given where our culture is at, and given, you know, 50 years of advertisements from the Surgeon General telling us that it's terrible, nobody doesn't know that it's bad for you. And yet people still choose to.
Yes.
So poor or not, you are morally responsible for that decision, and it is wrong to have someone else pay for the consequences of that.
Well, okay, so a couple things. Yeah, I'm going to get to that.
We can apply that to McDonald's just as well.
Sure.
People know that McDonald's is bad for you. And It does take a bit of forethought and planning, but there are ways to eat food that is not fast food and to eat food that is healthier, even on a poor budget.
So a couple things there. Like, you want to make this like hard distinction between, like, it's your decision, it's all your fault, that has nothing to do with any kinds of structural factors.
I wouldn't say nothing to do. No. I wouldn't say nothing to do with it. I would say perhaps the reason you're faced with this decision is structural, but it's still a decision that you're making. It's not like there are no options at all.
That's certainly true.
The particular set of circumstances in which you live has faced you with this choice, and you have chosen the way, just as I have chosen, again, and with my love of donuts, I have chosen a direction that is ultimately bad for my health.
Yeah, that's right. But
it was
why
a choice
do
knowing that it was the wrong thing to do?
Why do poor people smoke more than wealthy people? Is it just because they have weaker characters?
I would say that wealthy people have a different set of temptations that they undoubtedly give into just as much. I wouldn't say they have weaker characters. I think that the character is probably bad across the board, but in that particular instance, that is a temptation that the wealthy aren't confronted with.
And why is that? It's because they're wealthy.
Well, as far as smoking, I don't know.
Well, so look,
I don't actually know this.
This is why, you know, why are poor people more likely to smoke than wealthy people? Why are unemployed white working class people in the Rust Belt more likely to start using crystal meth than someone in Greenwich, Connecticut. It's because they're living in social circumstances that are, I mean, the reasons are obviously complicated, but one reason why is that they're living in social circumstances that are so extraordinarily stressful that they're looking for ways of relieving themselves of that stress and burden. That's why poor people smoke more than wealthy people.
Right. And they have chosen ways that are damaging to them. And I'm not even, at this point, I'm not even saying that, you know, we should therefore deny them health care. I'm just saying that we do not take the responsibility off of them. Just like when I make decisions that are bad for me, given the circumstances that I'm in, where I'm sort of at the, you know, lower middle mm-hmm. class, upper poor, wherever I fall in my particular town, when I make decisions that are bad, that's my decision, and I have to own that. I think that when we're talking, particularly when we're talking something that, if we go the direction of Europe, is it going to end up costing us 40%, you know, tax rates? We need to say, hey, look, there is blame to be had here, and it needs to be placed where it needs to be placed. On me for eating donuts, on, you know, the smoker for smoking, regardless of income level. I don't actually care about that as much. It's the life choices that you're making.
So a couple of things there. It seems like a lot of your argument is being driven by moral considerations as opposed to practical considerations. I mean, I want to suggest that when you follow the European model on healthcare, like, you're talking about, like, this escalating costs. But the argument is no, actually you don't get escalating costs. It's going to cost what it costs in other countries. Our healthcare costs are going to go down.
Does that factor in their tax rates? So is the amount of money that I'm out as a citizen of the United States going to be different than the amount of money I would be out were I a citizen of Germany? With the difference being, in this case, it's going to my doctor, my health insurance company. There it's going to the government, or the, I guess you said they were private, so Denmark or whoever, right? I mean, is at the end of the day, is it the same?
It's half as much, right? It's half as much. I mean, in Germany, you have a private healthcare insurance scheme. So you're still paying for your health insurance. It's just that the state of Germany tells doctors and insurers how much they can charge. So, I mean, in some ways, that's no different. It just, it costs half as much. But even if you had a private public or a public system, you know, instead of paying your insurer out of pocket your premiums, it's coming out in the form of taxes. But it's just half as much, right? So again, the whole point is healthcare costs in the United States are high because we live and we have this semi-private healthcare system regulating a market that is intrinsically resistant to free market efficiency. And when you have markets that are intrinsically resistant to free market efficiency, the best way to achieve efficient outcomes is by regulating them.
Well, and that's, yeah, we should use that, since we're running a little bit low on time, we should use that to transition into your argument for why our inefficient system needs the government added to it. Even more of the government added to it.
I've been making that argument the whole time because that's the only way to control costs, and you see it working everywhere around the globe except for the United States. But can I just go back to a quick point that you were making? So
yeah, sure.
Even if it was the case that it was going to cost less, would you still want to resist going in a more regulated route? Because For those moral reasons?
Maybe.
Right, so you were suggesting that it's morally wrong to force other people to underwrite other people's bad health decisions.
I'm not necessarily arguing that, and I want to get to our various proposals at the end. But I think at the end of the day, my answer to your specific question is no. I think it is okay to expect people in society to underwrite the terrible choices that other people make. I think that's one of the things you do as a society. But the way we are talking about doing it is where I'm going to disagree.
Can get back to that. I mean, I just want to say that, like, That's what it is to live in a cooperative society. Like, why should I pay for roads in Maine when I don't live in Maine? Why should I...
You shouldn't, Ed. You should pay for roads in California.
Yeah, so that's... I'm assuming you're joking there, right?
No, I'm serious. You should pay for roads in
California. And I shouldn't... So there should be no federal... So the interstate highway system is an abomination in your eyes.
That we can do an episode on that if you want to.
So yes, when absolutely. Did you become so libertarian in that way? That is such a great...
No. I'm absolutely not libertarian. But again, we'll get to that at the end. So if I've been angering our liberal listeners, just wait. I'll anger our libertarian listeners at the end of the episode. Because if I don't have a specific objection to some form of government subsidized or controlled or whatever healthcare in general. Anyway, we'll save that for the end. Obamacare specifically. So, sorry, sure. Just to move us along. Otherwise, we'll end up bogged down here. You mentioned the number 16%, and that's a number that comes out in 2006. So, in 2006, the Census Bureau reported that there were 46.6 million people without health insurance in the U.S., about 16% of the overall population. That's the number we heard kicked around when Obamacare was being touted as this great thing. That number is a lie, or at least if we leave it at 46.6 million, it's an inaccuracy. Although I suspect most people using it, it was an unintentional inaccuracy. Of that 46 million, 9 million are illegal immigrants. So sort of off the bat, it drops down to 35 million because whatever our obligations to each other as a society are, I think you have a harder argument to make that we should be funding people who are citizens of other nations also. So 35 million, another 17 million of that 35 million number lived in households with an income of more than $50,000 a year. Which suggests that they could have purchased their own insurance and either chose not to or were between jobs or something along those lines, which drops us down to about 18 million or about 6% of the population. Now, I don't know the breakdown exactly here, but of that original 46 million number, the Census Bureau report said that 18 million of them were between the ages of 18 and 34 and healthy and either didn't need insurance or chose not to purchase it. The numbers aren't clear in the census data. So, and of the non-elderly, 70% of that non-elderly 46 million number, 70% of them became insured within 12 months of the survey that was taken. So... again, 46 million, 16%, that number is just completely wrong at best. Like, at absolute most generous, it's
6%. So, I'm going to push back on that. Like, your point about the immigrants, I'm not just going to concede, but I'll concede that for the point of argument just for now. But that's fine if you subtract those as counting those among the uninsured, you also have to subtract them as being... as a percentage of our population. So even if you take out immigrants, that doesn't affect the percentage. I mean, it affects the absolute number, but it doesn't affect the percentage very much, right?
Well, hang on. Let's see. Math will tell us. It should affect
the percentage. Yeah, but not much.
You're dealing with, let's see, 35 million out of... So if we do the 35 million and then subtract out the 9 million illegal immigrants... that leaves us with 12% uninsured. And then if we factor out the other 17
million. Well, yeah, and so about the 17 million. So a lot of those people are... So you say live in households earning...
$50,000
or more. So, if I live in a household of four... and I have an income of $50,000, going out and buying health insurance isn't something that's going to be easy for me to do. I mean...
Well, right, but we have to use a number to cut off somewhere, right? I mean, obviously you've got to...
Well, sure, that's fine,
case.
But then the point is that it's not so easy just to take those people and say that they could have afforded it. They could have afforded it, but they didn't want to buy it, so these people don't really count, when in fact they couldn't really afford it, even though they were a middle-class family. But to me, the more telling issue is that when you look at the statistics of the people who chose to forego Obamacare, right? So the people who voluntarily chose not to purchase health care and prefer to just pay the penalty, that's 9%. Just 9%. The vast majority of people want health care coverage and can't afford it. In 2016, there were 27 million people who didn't have health care insurance. We could factor out the immigrants if you don't want them in there. But of all the people in the country right now who don't have health insurance, only 9% do so voluntarily. Almost everyone wants health care. But if you don't have it, it's almost certainly because you can't afford it.
Right. Let's see, one other statistic on Obamacare, of course, the costs, right, that have skyrocketed since the putting in place of Obamacare. In 2014, costs went up around the country on average about 25%, up to 85% in certain states, depending on which state they're looking at. And again, last year we saw the huge premium hikes.
Yeah. So a word about that. I mean, we have to be careful about which costs that we're talking about. Are we talking about the overall costs of healthcare in the United States, or are we talking about the costs of premiums on Obamacare exchanges? It's true that the price of healthcare policies continues to increase year on year, but the rate of increase since Obamacare has passed is significantly less than it was before Obamacare existed. So family premiums, so overall family premiums in the United States rose 20% from 2011 to 2016. So that's a lot. But in the five-year period before that, it was 31%. And in the five-year period before that, it was 63%. So it's true that overall healthcare premiums are increasing, but it's also pretty clear that they're increasing at a significantly slower pace than they were from before the institution of Obamacare. And now, with regard to the cost of the inflation of prices specifically on the exchanges in the Obamacare market, on like there are very specific reasons why those have gone up. And so for one thing, the cost of policies on exchanges varies quite a bit. So like in Phoenix, they were up like it was like some insane amount, like 100%. But in other places, like in Rhode Island, they had actually gone down 15%. And so there is a tremendous degree of variation between states. But like one question is, well, why did they go up so much? And the reason why they went up so much is because, so first of all, you're creating a new market out of scratch. And so it was hard for insurers to try to figure out exactly how to price things. And the problem was that health insurance, they had a hard time figuring out how much demand there was going to be from people using healthcare resources when they got insurance. So you typically have people who didn't have insurance, and now all of a sudden they have insurance. They're going to use healthcare resources at a higher rate than the normal population, right? Because they haven't had access to health insurance. And so their costs are going to be higher. And it was kind of tricky for insurers to try to figure out exactly how to price premiums because, you know, no markets existed before that. So the real problem was the fact that premiums were too low in the first year of Obamacare. People who got Obamacare in that first year ended up using healthcare resources at a higher rate than health insurers had anticipated. So in the second and third years, the cost of premiums went up significantly to try to make up the losses that they incurred in the first couple years. And a lot of insurers decided to leave the exchanges because they just decided it wasn't worth it for them.
That Rube Goldberg maze of insurance regulations that I think they talked about on National Review was too much for the insurance.
No, it was
for even insurance.
It was the fast. No. So again, they rose for very specific reasons because the newly insured used healthcare resources at a higher rate than they anticipated. The healthcare premiums in the first year were too low, but here's the thing: all of those problems are acute; they are not chronic. Right, they are acute because eventually the utilization of healthcare resources for that newly insured population would go down to regular levels and the costs would go down. And in fact, right before people started monkeying around with Obamacare, it sort of looked like healthcare usage was sort of returning to normal levels. So you're right, on the Obamacare exchanges, there was an extraordinary, there was in a lot of states, but not all states, but in a lot of states, really remarkable healthcare inflation.
46 of them.
But that was temporary.
Well, maybe.
Well,
we'll know this year.
But when you look at the causes for the all of the causes, why did they go up? I just gave specific reasons why they go up. And all of those reasons are acute. They're not long term. And then eventually
even
they would.
If we grant those reasons, there'll just be another set of reasons this year.
We'll
know in November, but I mean, my money would be on them going up.
Well, look, you got to give me a reason. You can't just say that there are a million reasons. I just gave you a specific argument. You got to deal with the argument. You can't just start waving
right.
your
and
hands
I don't,
around.
I don't know enough about these specifics, of course, to be able to engage in this. I can say we have not seen them go down yet. So at least the trend has been upward. So
yeah, but again, the trend is upward for like very specific reasons. Because when you don't have insurance and then all of a sudden you have insurance, you consume healthcare resources at a higher rate than people who've always had insurance. But eventually that's going to go back down.
So it's kind of a wait and see and hope.
No, it's
situation.
It's you would expect them to go down. Like if you hadn't been able to buy food, your first trip to the grocery store is going to be a huge load. But eventually you're going to end up buying groceries at the same rate as everybody else. You had a really unhealthy population, and now all of a sudden they have access to healthcare resources. They're going to consume more resources than everybody else. But then as they have access to those healthcare resources, their costs are going to go back down.
But have they gotten healthier?
Yes.
You're arguing that Americans are healthier now.
When you have access to healthcare resources, that's what healthcare resources do.
Having health insurance doesn't make you get on the treadmill and eat less sugar and white flour.
There's all of that stuff about the American diet. But again, so much of that is driven by the fact that people are just poor. I mean, like you're talking about the McDonald's a bit. Like, there's a reason why people go to McDonald's. Poor people go to McDonald's. The reason is that for the vast majority of disadvantaged people, they don't have access to grocery stores. They live in food deserts.
Right.
And then there are a host of other reasons as well. That you could call cultural if you want. But again, it's not as if culture just arises because people make bad decisions. Culture arises for structural reasons.
Well, and I would love to push back on that, but we are running low on time because we've both got places to be. How should we wrap this up, Ed?
We haven't talked about Ryan Care or Trump Care or whatever you want to talk about,
right.
Whatever you want to call it. So maybe we should talk about recent Republican Obamacare reforms?
Yeah, I mean, I have not followed it terribly closely. As I think you were pointing out before the show started, and what I've heard from various places is it's basically a watered-down version of Obamacare with some of the objectionable bits left in. But at least with the constitutional atrocity of the individual mandate removed.
That's something that I want to talk about before all of this ends. But
oh yeah, well, let's hit that. Ed, why should the government be allowed to compel me to purchase a service from a private industry?
So that's kind of why I'm trying to get clear on the source of your objection, whether it is moral or practical. So let's say everything that I say is true. And if we simply do what other countries do, then we will have similar healthcare costs and similar healthcare outcomes. Let's say we do all of those things and we go to a highly regulated market, whether it's technically single payer or not, I think is immaterial. But we do what Germany or Sweden or Switzerland has done. Let's say our healthcare costs cut in half and we get better healthcare outcomes. Let's say we do all of those things. Would you still be against purely for moral reasons? Because
I wouldn't say moral reasons. I would say it is unconstitutional for the federal government to take that kind of power to itself.
Well, so a couple things there. Like, I think we should talk about the more fundamental moral issues because you can't talking about moral issues is the more fundamental thing, and then we can sort of talk about
what the Constitution. If the Constitution does not empower the federal government to do something like that, it might be the best program ever. It might work perfectly. It's still wrong. Well, it's still unconstitutional.
But what if the Constitution is immoral?
Then we change it. Then we amend it. And if you want to start talking healthcare amendment, okay.
So a couple things there. I think what we should have the more fundamental ethical conversation, and then we could have a conversation about. Then we could have the more practical conversation. But I'm not even going to what bit of the Constitution? What bit of the Constitution is it violating?
So you're.
The federal government has the right to regulate the economy.
The federal government has some right to regulate the economy. It doesn't really have the right to regulate you or me individually in our economic choices. So does the federal government have the right to pass a law saying, Ed, you must shop for food at, so you're on the West Coast, so Albertsons, right, instead of Giant?
Albertsons and Vaughn's or something like that.
Right. So does the federal government have the right to say, Ed, you must shop for food here? We don't care what you buy when you go there, but you must go here. Would that be a legitimate use of the Commerce Clause, the Interstate Commerce Clause? Because it's better for everyone if you do so.
It depends, I would say. I mean, part of...
You can just say no, Ed. I mean,
come on. But part of the reason why that example is so ridiculous has to do with the specific pragmatics of what's going on in the market for buying food. If it was the case that food for everyone in the country was going to cost twice as much, then yeah, it would. But it's not the case.
I would say no, it doesn't, whether it's the case or not. Like, if the government doesn't have the power to do something, it might be really necessary and important, but we have these rules. And part of what makes our society stable and orderly and even to some extent virtuous is that we tend to respect our rules and governing documents that we've agreed to pay with.
Well, look, but you're making the constitutional point is such a distraction for me because we should be talking about the moral point. But what the Constitution says that the federal government has the right
to
regulate interstate commerce. What bit of the Constitution is being violated?
You, Ed Song, and me, Coyle Neal,
explain that to me.
Must purchase insurance is interstate commerce.
Yes.
How is that interstate commerce?
We're talking about spending money to purchase goods that traffic over state boundaries.
Yeah, but it's not just regulating what commerce is available. It's saying I must participate in it. I as an individual
I mean, that involves regulation. I mean, they regulate what drugs I can buy.
Yeah, but they don't make you buy them. They don't hold a gun to your head and say, Ed,
well,
you're going to buy
them. They don't make
you
me buy.
You have the right to say, no, I'm not going to buy those drugs, or I'm not going to buy any drugs. With health insurance,
you don't
want to have that choice.
So look, but again, part of what's going on there is that the examples that you're using are so distant from the nature
of
healthcare.
They're exactly the same. Food especially, right? If anything, it's more essential than healthcare because if you don't have healthcare,
you're going to survive for a while. Food isn't a second best market. Food is a first best market. And for what it's worth, I mean, the food that you're buying is subject to all kinds of federal regulations.
It is.
With regard to how it's produced and safety. So it's choosing to regulate it in a way that is in accord with the nature of the good itself. My whole point with healthcare was that healthcare is not like some other good. It's not like buying shoes or buying clothes or buying food. It is totally different. And you can see how it's totally different because we experience all of these inflationary pressures that we don't experience in other kinds of markets.
And I think I largely agree with you about most of what you said about the healthcare market. Again, that is not the same thing as saying, therefore, the federal government all of a sudden magically has the constitutional power to compel people to participate.
It says that it can regulate interstate commerce.
It can regulate healthcare, even if I grant that part of it, which I think I would probably grant that. That's not the same thing as saying it can compel you and me to participate. Any more than if it were to say, hey,
okay,
you must go to the grocery store in general and buy food. You don't get to have a garden and grow your own.
Okay, and so a word about that compulsion. So here's the thing. Healthcare in the United States is a big cooperative system. It produces benefits for all of us, but it only works if it's structured according to certain kinds of rules that everybody fairly participates in. when you consume healthcare resources, whether you're paying for them out of pocket, you're making use of that healthcare system in a way that affects everybody else who's using that healthcare system. So the analogy of forcing you to buy health insurance that you don't want isn't, that's not the comparison. If a person wanted to say, I will never use any healthcare resource in the United States for the rest of my life, then I would say, yeah, that's fine. They can exclude themselves. But you would have to remove yourself out of the cooperative system in order to fairly extricate yourself. It's not, because even if you were paying out of pocket, then you're making use of the system in ways that affect everybody else.
How is that not true of buying food in a way that how is that not true of, you know, buying a car and driving to work? I mean, again, in those areas, when you do something, you are affecting the rest of the system. That's just the nature of human life. In none of those areas would we say that the government can compel you to buy a car. In none of those areas would we say that the government has the constitutional power to compel you to buy food. Again, this is not a super system compared to these other things.
Where in the – so again, like, we keep on going back and forth between the constitutional and the moral point. And, like, going back to the constitutional interpretation episode that we had the last time, like, your whole point was it's not about whether a law makes sense or whether it doesn't make sense. It's about whether or not the state has the authority to do that. It would be stupid to do certain kinds of things, but it might well be within a state's constitutional authority. You got to tell me – it's like – now you're flipping constitutional interpretations. Where in the Constitution does it explicitly say that the government can't force you to buy something?
Well, I would look probably at the 9th and 10th Amendments. It doesn't explicitly say that it can, therefore, it's not a power that it has. And I would say that reading the Interstate Commerce Clause as a... And I think there's a reason that that the Supreme Court specifically did not read this as a Commerce Clause case. When they heard the Obamacare case, they said, look, this is a tax. Even though Obama didn't want it to be a tax, it didn't pass Congress as a tax. They say this is a tax and Congress has the right to lay it, because that's really the only constitutional authority the federal government has at this particular point to lay on us directly as individuals. But if you're asking me what sort of system, like what sort of moral system I'd be in favor with, I'm happy to go there if we're done with the rest of Trump care. I guess we should finish that first.
Well, we never really talked about it. But, I mean, you're basically right. It's basically Obamacare light. The big thing about Obamacare was the individual mandate. They got rid of the individual mandate. I mean, for what it's worth, I mean, you didn't actually have to buy health care insurance. You were just going to pay a tax penalty. And Ryan Care just replaced the individual mandate with penalties that you pay if you go uninsured and you buy back into
if you intentionally
insurance.
Go uninsured,
and it replaces,
right? It's not like if you lose it, but
and it replaces subsidies to buy insurance on the Obamacare exchanges with tax credits, and so it's all the same things. It's just less.
I haven't had time to follow the issue, but from what I understand, the biggest problem they ran into was the sort of artificial deadline they set for themselves of we must deal with this by. Was it last Friday? I think it's sort of across the board. The criticisms I heard were, look, this is a big deal. Don't give yourself, you know, 18 days of legislative action to work on it. Like, take time and do it right. And they just, for whatever reason, they didn't. And I don't know if I've seen any good explanation as to why they picked that arbitrary time, other than I suppose Trump wanted it in his first 100 days.
No, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they needed to do health care before they did the budget.
Right.
Oh, for somewhat technical reasons. But
so what's your let's hear your wish list for fixing American health care, other than sort of what we've heard so far. What would you do?
I don't know how to answer that question without talking about the things that we've talked about. I would go to something like the system that works in every other country in the world, where they pay less and get better overall healthcare outcomes. I don't know what's wrong with pay less, better overall healthcare outcomes. That sounds like a pretty good deal.
I distrust the federal government's ability to follow through on that, given.
Even though it works in literally every other country in the world.
Again, I don't know enough about the rest of the world to dig too much into that, but that is not the trend that we usually see when our federal government decides to get involved in something. And I think my fix, and again, I'm by no means an expert on this, so physicians out there, feel free to email us and yell at me. That's fine. My sort of ideal world fix would be transparency, first of all. So you talked a little bit at the beginning about how we just don't know what the costs of healthcare are. Often, even afterwards, we don't necessarily know. I mean, we sort of get a bill from the hospital or the doctor. Sometimes it's itemized. Sometimes it's all just lumped together, depending on various factors and things. Figuring that out beforehand, I think, would be a great help, knowing what the cost is going in. Obviously, you can't do that when you're gushing blood, but it is something that you could at least theoretically plan ahead for, given the opportunity. And we've seen some, in response to some of the costs of healthcare, we've seen some interesting efforts to try to offset it. There's a clinic in Springfield, Missouri, and I'm sure they exist other places, that's sort of a subscription type thing. Like, you pay $20 a month or $50 a month or something like that, and you just get sort of access whenever to the doctors. Like, it's you sort of join, and once they have as many people as they can fit, then they don't let any others join, but then they open a branch office and so on. So there are ways to sort of get around the lack of transparency. At least with that clinic, you know what it's going to cost. It's going to cost you, you know, $50 a month, and that's what your physician costs, and you can see him as many times a year as you want to. The bigger thing I would do, and I think this gets at some of your frustration earlier, is I would make whatever kind of healthcare system we're going to have local. I think the federal government is incompetent to create a national healthcare system, whether it's single payer or what have you. And I certainly think it doesn't have the constitutional authority to do that. If state governments want to give it a try, they can. We've seen that happen prior to Obamacare. Massachusetts, under Mitt Romney, Vermont had I think it was a German style system where if you were a citizen of Vermont, you had to buy Blue Cross Blue Shield, and that was your health insurance, and you had to buy it. Whatever I think of those individual plans, they're constitutional, and if they work for them, power to them. It means they can tailor the plan to their own state and that set it up however they want on their own level, which gets back to the question about roads. Should we be paying for roads across the nation? No, pay for roads in your own state. Same thing with healthcare. Like, if we're going to have some form of single-payer system, if we're going to be taking care of each other, as we ought to be doing, that should be done at a local or a state level, not at the federal level. So, yeah, that's where I would go. Again, very, very vague, but I'm not a healthcare expert.
I just don't understand this standing skepticism about the ability of the federal government to institute programs that make things better. It works in literally every other country in the world.
How's that war on poverty going, Ed?
So we could talk about that.
We could.
We can talk about that in another episode.
Or the war on drugs. Or, I mean...
We can talk about
that. You want the people who run the TSA in charge of your doctor.
Not the exact same people, but people who know something more about healthcare. Before the institution of Social Security, like, over half of older Americans were living in poverty. With the institution of Social Security, that rate is the poverty rate for seniors is like around 15%. That works.
So if we go back 80 years, we find a successful social program at the federal level. Maybe.
We could talk about Medicare. We could talk about Medicaid. We could talk about a whole range of problems. We can talk about the war on poverty. The reason why a lot of those programs haven't worked is because, like, the level of aid that's been given has been... And it's not to say that every program has been hunky-dory and that mistakes haven't been made. But even if inequality continues to be a problem, it's still the case that...
It's getting worse, even if inequality continues to get worse.
No, it's not getting worse.
That's not what Bernie Sanders said, Ed.
When you look at historical rates, the wealth gap between African Americans and white Americans is narrowing. The problem is it's just narrowing at too slow a rate.
And the wealth gap between rich Americans and poor Americans...
That's exactly right. It continues to grow because the wealth that's been generated in our country hasn't been trickling down. It's gone exclusively to Americans in the top quintile and really in the top 1%.
So the argument that this thing we've been doing for the last 50 years hasn't worked, therefore we need to do more of it, translating that into healthcare, I'm just incredibly skeptical of that.
So a couple things there. There's a difference between sort of talking about anti-poverty programs and growing inequality between the working and the upper classes. Those are big macroeconomic issues. That's one issue. We can talk about poverty, and I'll say, yeah, a lot of those programs were poorly designed. There's all kinds of, we know a lot more about the nature of poverty and things like that. But in general, when you look at the wealth gap between African Americans, Caucasians, and Caucasian Americans, it's narrowing. The problem is it's not narrowing fast enough. And again, in every other country in the world, it works. Like all those social programs,
if you want to import that into your state, awesome. Power to you. I would love to see our state legislature debate that. I think that would be only good could come from that kind of a public discussion here. So I think there is a better parallel between other nations and individual states, just because we are such a large nation. I mean, it's one thing to say this works well in you know, Denmark. It's another thing to say it works well in a large, diverse nation of 300 million people.
People make that point a lot. That's the strangest point, because when we're talking about economics, like, you generate economic efficiencies with regard to scale. It's not like size on this issue. It's not like smallness of size is a virtue in this issue. It's actually a vice.
Yeah, but it's not like
the economy, the greater the efficiencies you can squeeze.
Well, again, I'm not taking the libertarian view of this. I'm not saying that free markets are automatically the way to go. It may be that government involvement, again, at the state level is what's needed some places. Certainly regulation of some kind is going to be helpful. I'm just saying that needs to be scaled down. What works well in New York City is not a program that will work well in rural Georgia. A program that works well in rural Georgia won't work well in Los Angeles.
Why is there any reason to think that that's true with regard to healthcare? Is what the doctor is what the doctor is doing in New York City different than what the doctor is doing in Georgia when you have strep throat or a broken leg or need a knee replacement?
There are all sorts of differences. The number of patients that you see, the income level of the people that you're seeing, we could just go through all of the differences between, and that's just rural versus urban without getting into cultural differences. Of course there are differences. And getting into, you know, what sorts of system do the people of each of these regions and states want, I think that should factor into it as well.
I mean, to me, again, like this whole, like that whole kind of argument about that's fine for states is like such an artificial point in so many ways to me. But the real issue there is that, like, but healthcare, like this is a national, it's like, it's a national issue. Like, those doctors aren't just coming from rural Georgia. It's like, this is an issue that affects all of us. Like, you can't solve the healthcare issue by going with these little piecemeal solutions.
And again, I'm always a little blown away that the left will hold up Massachusetts and Vermont as these models of programs that worked, whether they worked or not, of course. We could argue about that, but hold them up as models that worked and then say, but we're not going to let the other states try the same thing. We're going to force this on everyone, even though they're both very different programs. We're going to pick one of them, force it on the whole nation, and say, this is what you're going to do, rather than letting states sort of do it on their own or not do it on their own.
The problem is, it's a big national problem, and it requires a big national solution.
Yeah, and it...
I mean, like, why not let states have, like, why not have states, like, run their own economic systems and issue their own currency?
Well, they're constitutionally forbidden from doing that, so there is that issue. As far as running their own economic system, states get to pick their own minimum wages. We could talk about all the differences in state labor laws, and I think those differences are, by and large, good, even if I think any one law is stupid. I think those differences are good differences. That sort of diversity is well, back to what I said at the beginning. We don't have a healthcare system in the United States, and that's a good thing. It means that we have We have many healthcare, as many healthcare systems as there are sort of independent health providers and patients who go to those independent healthcare providers, which means some places it's better and some places it's worse, but at least it's not all worse. We see a parallel to this with what's happening in education. I mean, people have talked for years about how terrible it is that, you know, education in Mississippi is so awful. So we move towards Common Core. We move towards No Child Left Behind. And what happens is all states start moving towards Mississippi. They don't all start getting better. I don't want the same thing to happen to healthcare in the United States. Practically, I think that this is better if left to states, local governments. Morally and politically, the Constitution does not provide the federal government the power to do it anyway.
Why do we have one economy and not 50 economies? Why do we have one army and not 50 armies?
Well, we do have
it's
50
because
economies,
all of those
though.
it's because all of those issues are like big national issues.
But Ed, we do though.
Just in the same way that healthcare.
We do have 50 economies. Some states are better off than other states. It's a great time to live in North Dakota right now. It's not a great time to live in California.
Yeah, but they're all
they're not unrelated.
They're all using the same currency and buying loans from the same kind of national market and getting funding from all around the country and insurance rates set by the same bank.
And that obviously they're not unrelated.
The big issue that I'm getting at is like it's a national problem. National problems, national issues require national solutions.
Well, and man, we should have gotten into places where healthcare is going well in the United States because it's not bad everywhere. But anyway, that's maybe we'll do another one at some point. Any final thoughts, Ed, before you got to take off?
You know, we often talk about recommended readings. There's a really great book by T.R. Reid called The Healing of America, which is this great sort of examination of what it's like to get healthcare treatments in a variety of different countries. That's a really lovely book. And then Stephen Brill wrote a really long essay a year or two ago in Time magazine called Bitter Pill. That's sort of an examination of all the paradoxes and pathologies of the American healthcare system. That was eventually turned into a book of a similar title, but that Time magazine essay is pretty great. And then just yesterday, I read a really great long article in the Times on Medicaid. That was really super interesting. So those are three things.
And I'll throw up the Forbes article about how free markets and healthcare don't really go together all that well. And I've been drawing at least some of this from a National Review article defending some of socialized healthcare. So I'll throw that up as well. And then we may or may not throw up the stats that we've been referencing. There are a lot of different sources, so that may get kind of overwhelming in the show notes. With all of that said, thanks for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We are members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. For more information about this show or any of our other shows, please visit ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes and like us on Facebook. If you have comments, please leave those at Facebook or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. On behalf of Ed, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high